A Net for All? Where are the minorities? Recorded at CFP 95, the 5th Conference on Computers, Freedom, and Privacy, in San Francisco, California, on March 30, 1995. Deborah Runkle from the American Association for the Advancement of Science will introduce the panelists.
First, Armando Valdez, who is the founder of LatinoNet. He is a doctor of communications and a scholar in the Bay Area. He currently has a fellowship where he is studying access and equity on the information highway for people of color.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I think this is a very important session for a number of reasons. I think it'll be a little more evident as I continue talking. Let me tell you a little bit about the kind of work I do and some of the assumptions that frame the work I do. Actually, it's two very simple assumptions, two very obvious assumptions that you may or may not agree with. First assumption is that information indeed is power, the ability to access information, the ability to use information, the knowledge that it may bring and may offer is indeed something very empowering. The other premise is a sociological premise, and that is that in this society, as is true of most other human societies, we have an experience, a phenomenon that we call stratification. That means that we're not all at the top, we're not all at the bottom, we're just sort of spread out. And what's important about that is that in some societies we have a sociological process called structural inequality. Structural inequality means that we create or we organize our system in ways that some people have more access, some people are more empowered than others by virtue of where they are in that structure. It's not necessarily a static model, but nonetheless it begins to explain some differences qualitatively, quantitatively, about the kind of society we have. Now those are important premises that frame my work simply because we right now are, in my view, on the cusp of a very important phenomenon. That is, we are transforming the infrastructure to the next generation technology. We're moving from analog to digital. We've talked about it. This group, I think, I'm sure, is very aware of that phenomena. But in terms of deploying that technology, it's going to be coming out of the test beds, out of the specialized groups into mass society. So it's an historic moment. I think it's very important that we look and we think about the kind of information society we would like to participate in and that we would like to create. And that, to me, is why this conference is so important. I think we need to not make assumptions, but rather be critical of where we are as a society, be critical of where we are as individual professionals, as well as individual members of the society. I've been concerned not simply with questions of access, but also questions of equity. Again, the point about structural inequality and stratification. I left the academy actually 5 years ago to begin working in a more applied setting, doing different kinds of things. And one of the things that I've done that I'm proudest of is LatinoNet. And I'll talk for maybe 1 minute about that and pass the mic on to my colleagues. We began to wrestle with the question of equity and access to information technology. We were aware of the phenomenal growth and phenomenal power of the internet and that technology, online services. So we began to think about how do we find a way to see that this technology does not trickle down to our communities, Latino communities, because we indeed need access to the information knowledge networks of the future to empower communities. And the approach was to really do a ground-up organizing process. We incubated the concept here in the Bay Area. We invited, in an open democratic process, all Latino nonprofit organizations to work with us. Of the 200 and some odd, 50 of them signed on literally to work with us for a year to first of all learn about network technology and secondly to use that knowledge to design a system. And that's the way LatinoNet grew. We had some notions of what needed to be there, the kinds of information, the kind of features, the kind of interface, the kind of costs, and the kind of support that was needed and training that was needed to make this happen. We then took that concept and took it to the Los Angeles region, which is the country's largest Latino population, Latino urban area, and we debugged it. We learned a lot. We learned about politics. We learned about the fit between social, economic, political needs and technology and so forth. November of last year, we launched LatinoNet as a public We publicly launched it, but LatinoNet is a private area on America Online, And the concept of LatinoNet really is to try to not only provide access to the technology so people can use information on the net or whatever, but to provide a very rich information environment where information that is relevant for Latinos resides. But beyond that also, an environment through which Latinos can become not only consumers of information, but producers as well. To us, that's a really key concept. You know, technology is simply a tool. Getting access to computers is wonderful. And we now are committed to find ways to raise money to actually provide modems, not to every single home, but to Latino nonprofits that serve the communities. We identify the nonprofits as essentially the not only the service providers, but the advocates, the caretakers, the educators of the community. And we think that that's a place to start. So we're embarked on a grand voyage to try to make a difference in a significant way. In my view, the solutions right now are not coming from the universities. The solutions are not coming from government. I find the most creative and refreshing solutions coming from folks like yourself and folks in the community that have some needs that band together and create partnerships. And I want to encourage all of you here to try to find a way to penetrate that virtual reality, the sort of the wide computer cyber world, you know, go to the real reality. Go out and connect with people out there that can use this wonderful technology that, and find a way for you to become a partner, become a change agent in that process.
Next is Cynthia Harvey. She's a professor of computer science and, as a matter of fact, was the founder of the computer science department at Morgan State University, which is a traditionally black university in the Baltimore area. She is also affiliated with the Goddard Space Center and runs an internet service and brings minority, particularly African-American scientists and space scientists together. She has been a pioneer woman engineer and mathematician and has a lot of firsts before her name in almost every job she has. She's been the first.
The title of the session is A Net for All, Where Are the Minorities? And I think those of us who can see will look around and probably have asked ever since you got here, yes, where are they? Because since I've been here and I got here Tuesday, there are not too many identifiable ones. Of course, we can't always go by what we see. But the question certainly is relevant about where are the minorities? I think at least we can say, as far as the minorities of African American descent, that there are a few of them here, very few. And I've been to the Internet Conference, the ACM conferences, IEEE, DPMA, and all of these conferences, and they're not there. Further, I think we all agree to that. Further, I think most of us would agree to the fact that the Internet is going to exacerbate the disparity between the haves and the have-nots. There have been many sessions on that since I've been here at this conference, so I think we all agree to that. Where there seems to be a great disagreement is what is to be done about it and who is responsible. I have been in a state of shock ever since I went to the Grace Hopper conference last year, where when the question came up about what should be done about it, and everybody at that conference seemed to thought nothing much, that was up to each group to take care of itself. And that's easy to say, but not necessarily easy to do. Now, I think everyone has a stake in seeing that all of the citizens of this country have access. This doesn't mean you give them something, but at least that it's made possible for them to have access. And I don't say this because I think we're all good fellows or that we would feel guilty and therefore we want to, you know, some people feel guilty about the thing about the 40 acres and the mule, you didn't get it, so maybe we should give you something. I don't think that any of those reasons apply. I think everyone has a stake in it and should be involved purely out of self-interest. Maybe most of you have heard, and it came up at the end of the last census in 1990, that it's anticipated that by the turn of the century, the year 2000, that the population of the United States will be one-third minorities. And at the time that was stated, in 1990, everyone said, well, it gives us 10 years to see what we need to do to prepare for this eventuality. But I say, wake up, hello, look around, this is 1995. and that's less than 5 years away. Therefore, something needs to be done, and I don't think that enough is being done to address the issues and look at the possibilities. One of the things I see is the danger is that while a number of the people here and others like us, I include myself in that, are off in cyberspace experiencing a virtual reality, but there are a lot of people and a growing number of them who are existing in real time and in real space experiencing real hardships and real reality. Many of these people may be becoming more and more alienated and more disenfranchised or disenchanted, becoming more and more separated economically and socially. And the last session brought this up too about the change in the social and the economic position of these people, that it's becoming further and further separated. And these people are perhaps crying out for a piece of the pie while we're off in cyberspace. And if we aren't aware, we can, as our system, could be endangered by this kind of activity. So I would suggest that we all have an interest in seeing that all of our people have the opportunity to participate and to grow and to be educated in these modern technical activities. Now, and of course, it's been stated that by the decade of 2010 that 1/3% will be even larger. Now, this is not to say nothing is being done. Certainly there are things being done. But since most people are not involved in what's being done, the question I would like to answer is, what can each of us do? Well, one thing, if we know some of the activities that are going on, then there may be possibilities that we can support some of them, or we can see that they grow or are, continue to have access. For instance, I'm working with a program sponsored by Goddard Space Flight Center called MUSPIM for Minority University Space Interdisciplinary Network. And I find it interesting when people say, well, we don't need to help anyone because you can pull yourself up by your bootstrap. But in my experience in going to some of these small, historically black colleges who are responsible for training people and finding that some of them don't even have bootstraps, I won't go into the details on that, but you, if you, again, want to know more about it, I would be happy to answer some questions. There's also been a Congressional Black Caucus Foundation-sponsored conference on African Americans in the telecommunication age, and things like this are to be encouraged and supported, as opposed to what's being proposed in Washington now, which is to cut back on that particular group's ability to hold those kind of conferences by not providing any federal funds. That may be okay, but at least maybe we can encourage some of the private foundations to support those kind of activities. The National Science Foundation has some initiatives, and there are many initiatives going on, which if you need more information or desire, I would be happy to provide. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is Randy Ross, who is from the Native American community and has been active in a whole variety of issues, cultural activities, art activities. And most interestingly, and the reason he's here, is the very active use of the internet that has been made by the Native American community.
I come to you from Rapid City, South Dakota in the Black Hills. I'm glad to be here. Language is an interesting thing, isn't it? And I think coming into the 21st century, the information age, we're looking at tribal communities are still dealing with this issue of cultural survival. And we have, when I look onto the reservations and the communities that are there, there's a lot to be protected, a lot that needs to be valued. And there's a lot about the communities that are there that somehow we have to work a little bit harder to meet these new challenges that we're being faced with. And it's my understanding that this group had a chance to listen to a gerrymander the other day, and actually that was one of the earlier works that I've started to inspire and trigger some of my thinking. And his particular book was In the Absence of the Sacred, the Failure of Technology and Tribal or Indian Communities. And that, and I don't know how many of you read it, but I suggest you read it. It's a book that talks about the impact of the values, the belief systems, the impact of, in his instance, was the impact of British Broadcasting Corporation being moved into northern tribal groups in Canada who were never previously exposed to broadcast mass communication mediums. and to look at the social phenomena and exchange and the impact on social and cultural values and whether the positives and the negatives and how you balance that out. I think we're kind of at the same similar crossroads of how do tribal communities view converging and emerging and fast, rapid pace technology developments, how the broadcasting community, as we look at the regulatory environment that's moving supposedly towards a deregulated condition, and also the idea about content providers and access. Again, what does all that mean to our tribal communities, and as we look at, again, the social impact, the values. In the past, we looked, you know, to give a broad background, you know, and I have to, a disclaimer here, I'm not a lawyer, but as tribal communities, I can say that Indian people of any group know so much about government. you know, you go to the BIA and you get the answers there. You know, it's in the, we have a whole book called USC Codified 25 devoted to Indians. We're the only group in this country who gets to have a 3-inch memento about our position in this country. It gives us a unique position. I think there's some things that we can share as a community, but retrospectively, when you look at the Interstate Highway Act, it has not served tribal nations very well. Either it was plowed right through them, or it went around. Either way, you know, we can look at some diminished effect, some disintegration, and again, we talk about the term came up, cultural integrity. These are concerns that we have, but how do we balance that with the need for economic and commerce and access to educational and medical services and so forth? Cultural rights, I think, is something that is interwoven into our concern about how the digital future, what are the electronic laws that will, how will they view and respect community-based values regarding cultural properties. And in our case, we have a real battle at home about defining what we call inalienable communal property. That is, one individual does not have the right to take an item and go out and sell it on the market. I mean, these are characteristics of other tribal cultures as well, but this is something, how do you keep those kinds of things intact so you don't get, you have the gerrymander absence of the sacred effect impacting your community in very adverse ways. So I think that's, you know, I just wanted to just kind of point out that the broad framework of federal Indian law and policy, there's still, the tribes are looking at ways, they are sovereign. I think there's numerous record of statutory federal law, judicial opinions, court documents, the Constitution, and the treaties that indicate that tribes and all the interpretation have limited sovereign status or dependent sovereign status. But now we're faced with how do tribes deal with the jurisdiction and regulation of electronic resources that are within the confines and the boundaries of federal Indian reservations. And so this is kind of the new challenge. The FCC folks really don't have an intersection in their laws and regulations that really really help us understand where tribal rights might begin or end. And so there's already been some court cases. The Mojave, Fort Mojave tribe in Arizona has already kind of bumped heads with the FCC over can they declare themselves as a cellular common carrier provider and applied for licenses for services that cover their reservation. Well, the FCC ruled against them, saying that sovereignty and so forth is not a determinant. And the FCC ruling says that you have to go at it as a minority under their definitions of the 1992-04 Communications Act amendments. These are really big issues, and I'm not going to be able to cover them all for you this morning, but I think that it's something that kind of, the idea of sovereignty reaches a lot of folks, and even the Native Hawaiians have some issues, the Pacific Islanders. I think as communities, we look at cultural rights, cultural expression. I think that there's an incredible amount of work that needs to be done, particularly with respect to the intellectual property and how do we begin to look at some of these incredible issues that are going to impact our communities long term. So I'll just kind of cease and desist on that one, hey?
Art McGee is a participant in a number of internet activities, including the Institute for Global Communications, computer networks such as PeaceNet, EcoNet, LaborNet, and Conflict Net.
I'm sort of still, you know, amazed that I'm even here today because compared to a lot of the other folks here, I'm sort of, you know, just a lay person. I mean, I'm a technical person. I've, you know, been involved with computers for many years, but in terms of, you know, being a net activist or being really heavily involved in these types of issues, I'm new to a lot of this. And it's sort of, you know, an honor for me to have been invited to be here and to participate on this panel and to have the opportunity to speak, you know, to some of these different issues. I've mostly been involved, in addition to being, you know, particularly concerned about issues dealing with communities of color. I've also been particularly interested in the issue of communications technology and how it relates to Black and African communities and what different issues that they may have to wrestle with in terms of using the technology, what effects it could have on their communities, both commerce-related effects as well as consumer-related effects. And so this is some of the work that I've been doing. I wanted to sort of bring up a few points or some issues that have sort of been running through my head lately. Sort of maybe you could hope the audience could sort of help me out in sort of mulling through these, because I think there's some important concepts and things that haven't really been dealt with properly, but that sort of through urban legend, these sort of facts have been passed around, or these absolutes have been passed around, and people say, oh, okay, that's the way it is, and, you know, and say, yeah, did you know that it's this way? And I think that maybe we need to sort of do some more critical thinking about some of these issues. The first one that comes to mind is the, you know, everyone's pretty much familiar with the New Yorker cartoon of the, you know, the two dogs sitting at a computer terminal, and one dog is, you know, showing his friend how great the internet is, and he turns to the computer literate dog turns to the other dog and says, "On the internet, no one knows you're a dog." Well, if I had drawn that cartoon, I would have had the other dog turn right back and look back at his friend and say, "What's wrong with being a dog?" Yeah. And one of the things that bothers me about the whole concept, or this whole concept of losing or being able to lose identity, and it sort of ties in with the need to have sort of a more diverse participation at a conference like this, is that there are certain issues such as that that have unique significance to quote-unquote minority groups or individuals that other populations may not be aware of. Whereas, say for example, losing, being able to go online and have a lack of clues as to your class, or whether you're ugly, no offense to anyone in the audience, or, you know, or gender, those are important. But in particular, when you look at how minority people, Native Americans, African Americans, have been treated historically, the issue of identity takes on a particular significance. It's been the cause for death, of being attacked, of being, you know, literally in many cases, you know, wiped out or hung or, you know, different sorts of, it's not just something to play with. It's not just something that, you know, we say, oh, well, I can do this today and tomorrow I'll be back out in the real world. And so that's an issue that I, you know, hope that, you know, when you go away from this panel that you're sort of thinking about that, that and become more aware of the fact that your sort of a belief in that idea of being able to assimilate or lose the identity may not, that sort of that desire to do that may not be as widely valued in the greater society. Another issue that comes up, for example, in relation to privacy, sort of more of a class-related issue. It has to do with the fact that often, in particular, it's also racial, but it's sort of class and race combined, having to do with the fact that if you're poor, and for example, or poor people often have to seek government-related services more frequently than the general population in many cases, and that the ability to sort of be anonymous or keep things to yourself, you sort of lose that by default because you don't have the same options of dropping out or staying free or staying, you know, underground, so to speak, that you're sort of forced to give out, you know, your everything about yourself to be tracked because of a lack of trust of your character or because just simply that's what's required of government reporting. And I think that's something that a lot of people aren't, you know, don't think about as much or aren't as aware of, that privacy issues are somewhat different depending upon social status or class or race. And I think that's something that, you know, needs to be thought about a lot more. Another issue has to do with just how historically technology's been used. Everyone here is, you know, it's sort of ingrained in, I guess, in American culture to sort of have sort of adversarial relationship with law enforcement or police. But once again, in particular to minority communities, and I can particularly speak for African American communities, it's even a greater sort of animosity, a sort of greater adversarial relationship between the government, law enforcement, and how technology has been used to track or to, you know, control people. And these are the types of things that, you know, need to be looked at a lot closer. One other thing, this is sort of more on the positive side, I would say, it's probably pretty obvious. Being able, or the power of the technology to allow people to express themselves in ways that they haven't had the opportunity to do before. This takes on a particular significance for minority communities because of the fact that, you know, access to the press, access to mainstream media, the ability to put out images that are not, that are not stereotypical or that are counter to stereotypical images is something, you know, we've been sort of bombarded by, you know, these images that are, you know, controlled by other people or what they view us as. And so the net has sort of a particular importance to communities of color and being able to express ideas or to express ideas, put out images and do other things that are they are controlling without sort of the traditional media as the middleman or the having to come crawling to the traditional media all the time in order to have your side of the story or your viewpoint expressed. And one other thing that I wanted to emphasize, that even though I'm a techie type person and I love computers and could pretty much just sit in front of one and not eat all day, I think that one thing that needs to be emphasized, that with no matter how great all this is, that one thing that needs to be done and or looked at more closely is just having better basic education. I think too often we get off on this track of computers will, you know, revolutionize this and it will increase learning that, and that you have a group of people out there who are illiterate or who are just barely literate, and that all the computers in the world won't help them until they're at least able to, you know, read. And so I think that's very important. It's for example, one of the reasons that no matter, I'm always a big advocate of public radio. No matter how many computers you have in a rural area or a less developed country or in an inner city, there are always going to be situations where people who can't read but they can understand hearing the words over radio. You can always have a transistor radio carrying with you somewhere to receive information. So we shouldn't just look at the computer as sort of this, oh, this is all we need, we can get rid of everything else, we don't need any other media, it's all going to be through this, and forget about the rest of it.
So with that, I'd like to start having some questions for the panelists, and then, not very long because I know the time is going, I'd like to open it up to the audience. But first, I'd like to ask the panelists if they could elaborate perhaps on some programs that they're aware of, either in their organizations or others, which are trying to address some of these issues. We'll start with you in a minute. We'll start with the panel.
Yes, there are many things going on to try to overcome these problems. One activity that I'm involved with is, and this is a government activity, but I think it's pretty creative. I'm a professor at Morgan State University, but because of my 30 years of addressing this problem, of course I don't look that old, but I've been working 30 years in addressing the problem, and I was invited to come to work with NASA Goddard Space Flight Center for 2 years to work with minority universities, because one of the ways the majority universities get all of this equipment and get on the network and do all the work that they do is that they get grants from the government to do research. And the minority universities don't get the grants because they don't have anything to attract a grant with. For instance, NASA says in order for you to get a grant from them to do research, you must be on the network so that you can get the data. And once you're on the network and get the data, then they'll give you millions of dollars, and of course you can buy other things. But the minority universities weren't connected to the network, therefore they did not qualify for a research grant, therefore they got no money. So what this program is called MUSTEM, Minority University Interdisciplinary Space Network, goes to minority universities and teaches them how to build their own network and how to connect themselves as opposed to going out and buying the expensive parts and hiring consultants and these things. And once they can get some kind of infrastructure inside the university and get a network set up in the university, then NASA can guarantee to connect them to the outside world. They can't do anything on campus, but they can take that connection and take it to the outside. Then they qualify to apply for grants. We've been to, about 25 universities so far, and these universities are not just historically black, but it includes the consortium of Native American universities. So we've been to South Dakota and New Mexico, and also the Hispanic institutions. So we've been to Puerto Rico and places like that. And there are quite a few of them in California that are on the list. Most of them we can identify by being Title III schools. And the number of schools now that have qualified for research grants, which means now they can train more people in their areas to learn to use the network. Now, when the person at that conference said to me that we didn't need to help anyone because the software for getting on the internet is free, it never occurred to them to know that how did you get that free software that's out there on the network? Huh? How do you get it? You have to be on the network to download it. And if you're not on the network, you can't get the free software. So that was a big shock. So these are the kinds of things that are happening. If you don't have it, you can't get it. So there need to be ways of empowering people. Now, one other little thing, I have to put a plug in for myself. And I said I've been doing this for 30 years. I used to work in industry where I made money. And I realized that I had a long conversation about 35 years ago with someone saying, well, with computers coming along, and this was before microcomputers, you know, you'd had the big things, that this is the opportunity for the African-American community to make its mark, because most immigrant populations, when they came over, there was some new thing that came along that they got in on at the beginning and gave them the opportunity to become, you know, full-fledged citizens. And I said, well, gee, the only way I can see doing that, I can't do it where I'm working, is if I go into the university and have an impact on students. So I can at least say by this time I have taught computer science to about, 8,000 students who some are now in industry and some are starting businesses of their own. Some of them are teaching at other universities. So it's like a little pebble, you know, some ripple is going out. And so each of us has to take a responsibility to do something, whatever within our power. And it may be within your power to say, well, they're cutting NASA's budget, but tell them don't cut MUSTEM. Or there may be other things that you hear about, you know that we're downsizing, but maybe we have to be careful what we cut out when we downsize and not cut out all the opportunities that are currently being generated to help people, you know, become full-fledged citizens.
Some additional comments, and as a follow-through to some of my opening statements there, that gets back to the presidential, the current presidential Indian policy, and I just like to see other activities. The Office of Technology Assessment is currently going through a report process for a Center to Inouye commissioned a study to look at the impact of telecommunications technology in American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians, and that study will be completed, I believe, in May or early June for public distribution and of course to the members of Congress. And there's a great intense effort to try to compile and to look at a lot of these critical priority issues that are impacting these various communities. But to put some context to that, in 1994, President Clinton, and there's been numerous previous federal Indian policy statements, but this is the latest one. In 1994, Bill Clinton says, "Today I reaffirm our commitment to self-determination for tribal governments. Today I pledge to fulfill the trust obligations of the federal government. And today I vote to honor and respect tribal sovereignty based upon our historical relationship." And you have to remember to put that in context. Indian tribes gave up millions and millions of acres of land. A lot of lives were lost. And it was not too long ago, 100, 150 years, there's this foundation and framework that the tribes talk about unfunded mandates. You know, but this is something that we're trying to define. Where are we going to own up to these situations? So that intersection has got to happen. That nexus between the FCC and where are we going to open up some new channels here? The OTA study will be important to open up that dialogue and a new beginning of perhaps a new discussion to create those new chapters in Felix Colhin's Federal Indian Law Handbook. That we've been fighting for years now for jurisdiction over water rights, hunting, fishing, minerals, subsurface, surface mining. And this is something that I feel that impacts all Americans as we look at how we conduct ourselves, our behavior. So I think the net and the connectiveness and the information exchange, all those things will benefit all communities. And I think as soon as tribes can take control and ownership of determining where they're going, the self-determination factor, building their own information economies, and then sharing that information, in distinct ways that protects their communities, and their local image, and their dynamic. So those are just kind of some encompassing comments I'd just like to offer. So thank you.
Did you want to say something? Oh sure. I didn't have anything in particular that special to say except that one of the things that I try to do. When I talk to people or write or whatever, is to point out that even with sort of all the doom and gloom of, the lack of access or the different, cultural issues and other things, that there is a lot of good going on out there, that there are a lot of grassroots efforts, that there are a lot of good organizational efforts to give people more access, that are completely independent of government, but also in some ways connected with the government, but that the main point to make is that people aren't simply sitting around and waiting for a solution, that they're not just sitting and saying, oh, when will Al Gore get here to rescue us? They're going out, they're doing everything from running a bulletin board system in their basement to planning, setting up their own internet service provider type thing. And so that's the main point I want to get across, is that it's not all bad news.
Okay, we're going to take questions now. And given the time and the number of people, I would request that you ask a question and not give a speech.
Camera people don't usually get to ask questions, but I figure this is a different kind of conference, so I will. My question is really to Mr. Ross, but to anybody else on the panel who'd like to help out. I listen to National Public Radio and the Native American News, and I really never hear anything about the net on there except an occasional statistic about the number of modems on tribal American lands. And it occurs to me as a member of the PGP development team that one of the things that Native Americans could do to help both themselves and everybody else and get an awful lot of attention from the government real fast would be to promote the use of anonymizing remailers on Native American lands. It seems to me that since my ancestors apparently came over here and stole your country, that you have a certain right to sovereignty, and I think that shouldn't be taken away from you, and I think you should make the most of that. And I'd like to know if you can possibly educate me and everybody else here about any kind of initiatives that are being taken in that direction. I'd really appreciate it, and I'd be glad to offer my assistance and volunteer my efforts in that area as well. So please tell me what's going on with that.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Interesting question.
Yeah, we'll have to go to Europe and stake a claim there, huh? See if that works first. from an infrastructure standpoint, many of the reservations
I heard it this morning. The way the system was set up in the beginning, you talk about ladder boundaries and so forth, the in-state, the high cost of toll access, is just those switches, the remote terminals. If you look at how the infrastructure is designed, those switches are located off the reservation in most cases. But the economics of telecommunications, the taxation of services on that, the federal Indian land thing just hasn't fit into the current model of local regulated monopolies and how they set up and how their revenue streams are developed. Indian people tend to pay a lot of money to be in connection with relatives. Even within the boundaries of the reservation, they're crossing a couple of these ladders and they're paying in-state toll distances because of the pricing, again, the pricing schemes that are that we're currently faced with. 25% of Indian homes, as an average, have phone service. Some information says it might be as high as 50% in some reservations, but it varies. But most, due to economic conditions and the high cost of access of just basic phone service, we're talking communities who don't even have access to 911. With health conditions are fairly deplorable, but when you can't even contact the ambulance because you don't have 911, we have a lot of problems here. And the local RBOCs and or the RBOCs and the telcos aren't going to come in and fiber up the reservation because the subscriber per loop revenue requirement doesn't meet a standard that they want. That's why it's so important, I think, that tribes look at this infrastructure issue. If they can determine their own regulatory environment, set up their own switches, force some interconnectivity agreements so they can have that 911 so that they can call local within a 500-mile radius if they want to, local. We're talking about calls terminated from one federal Indian reservation land to another one. Calls terminated, calls originated, and then terminated on federal Indian land. Can tribes set their switches up to set up a tribal network that sits in its own regulatory regime? Those are things that we need to look at so that we can provide a better, broader service and a better social impact to our communities. So yeah, there are some big issues out there, and I could go on and on, but I'll work on that European trip.
David Vest with Victims of Credit Reporting. We've had a large number of people that once belonged to this group that can no longer access the net because all of the major graphical interface providers require credit cards. There's also a move afoot now to require monthly credit checks for access to the net through the major providers. I've heard some hope here in issues of regarding alternative networks. I'm wondering if you have any suggestions how the 1/4 of Americans that are currently unable to obtain credit cards can obtain access to the net at the same time. AOL certainly won't let you. Neither will Prodigy, CompuServe. I can go on and on.
I can only really speak for IGC. We have several different options for signing up to our services. Credit card is obviously, you know, the most popular, but we also, you know, monthly billing, prepayment, check-free. So we're very flexible in terms of understanding that our user community may not, you know, all be using credit card, may not be able to use credit cards to sign up for the service. I think that's something that more service providers should do, is add more options and be more flexible.
Yes, I'm involved with an organization, Metropolitan Austin Information Network, back in, it's called MAINE, and what we're kind of like a community network. Essentially what we do now is that we provide like web and gopher pages to community groups in and around Austin. And my question is, I wonder if you had any advice or recommendations for one, for its, for MAINE to be more effective in, you know, bringing these minority groups online, and also like if there's anything that we should say to these, I'm thinking of like community newspapers and organizations that aren't online now about why they should be online.
Well, I guess in general, from the tribal communities that I'm aware of and working with, the whole tech transfer issue of getting them. The hardware and software is part of it, part of the problem, regulatory and the affordable access issue. So in other words, there's a whole combination of issues, but most certainly helping. A lot of this stuff is so abstract when you can go into a tribal council that barely understands how switch networks work for basic phone service. Then you're talking about, well, we want to upgrade this so you can do at least ISDN or some voice video data application. And boy, you lose them right off the bat, and then you got to somehow take it out of the abstract to really show what the benefits are. And then you could talk about access to hordes of government information. Hopefully it's useful. some of it's not useful. But even then, that's what I mean. There's a whole vast sea of unfiltered information out there that how do tribes begin to build their capacity internally, or communities, or you could say a community or a tribal library or a tribal college or, you know, or whatever the entity is. Showing examples, I think, if you're going to communicate with them, is there's so much talk now about putting things up for web pages. I've already seen sales pitches that will put stuff up for 8 cents. They had all these cost schedules all figured out, so it costs that. But what are they really getting out of that? And so you pay per much to hang a page up per month in Mosaic, and so it really it's like the application and what is it? What is the benefit and value going to be of having stuff posted out there that's relevant to them? I can see the potential for curriculum development. We have to talk about learning styles, cultural learning styles. I really see this whole revolution thing kind of coming back full circle. We're going back to the pictures and drawing, and the idea of learning styles that are traditional learning styles that include voice, sound, and you know a whole mix, a kind of a holistic thing. So I really see that while the jury's still out a lot of ways, I really see that there's going to be receptiveness to looking at new ways, and so I think that whole learning issue is really a key area. So.
Yeah, that's an interesting question about how you get people to realize the value or the potential for being on the network. I had an interesting experience this past semester. One of my classes decided to do a survey of the minority businesses in the metropolitan area because there was a directory that they could use that identified all the businesses. And they asked them first whether they'd heard of the internet and if any of them had heard of it, you know, were they using it, and if so, how. And it was just amazing how many had not even heard of the internet. And then after they had done their survey and we had a discussion about what it meant, one of the things the students observed was that the smaller businesses were the ones who had heard the least, and the larger businesses had heard a little more. And of course, all these were small compared to the mammoth businesses. But it came about that some of them had experience with saying that some of the businesses that were successful and larger were ones that were on the internet because they had been able to transact some business and attract some customers. So what we think we'll do, and this just happened this past year, is to have the computer society and the students in the courses to come up with some sort of way of contacting the businesses after they put together a document saying what you can get out of being on the internet, because they really don't know. And this goes with what you said, there needs to be some curriculum development or changes, because the curriculum that we found, even in computer science, was pretty much an SACM curriculum we're following, was developed long before networking really took over. So we do need to do some changes there also.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to offer a comment. Our experience was that we permitted the organizations to define what information was useful to them, and not so much, it was not technology driven, the idea of getting on the net or using the net and so forth. The idea is, what information do you need to have access to and what form? And once that question was addressed, you know, there was no question about, you know, do I use the net? I mean, it's there and so forth. So I think it's important to think about not the technology, but rather, you know, people in any walk of life will use tools available to them if they value those tools, if it'll get them what they need, be it a car, be it a computer, be it whatever. And we had significant success with that.
My question is to the whole panel about some of the long-term trade-offs between community building versus building bridges across communities. Much of the emphasis here and in other fora has been on the value of these technologies to bring together like-minded people with common interests around the world, whether it's minority interests, political, religious, or all the computer-literate dogs who want to talk to each other. And on the one hand, this is certainly an empowering approach, but I'm seeing increasing concern on the other side, and even scholarly concern, that what's happening is that like-minded people are splitting off into smaller and smaller groups who talk to people who have the same attitudes, the same political opinions as each other, and are not confronting people who have different opinions and different interests, and we're actually maybe using this technology to move away from the community building and the broader set of interests and the public dialogue that we really need to have. And I'm very interested in what all of you have to are thinking about in terms of long-term trade-offs of building your own communities versus building bridges across communities and a broader public dialogue.
I'd like to respond to that. I mean, it's, I began getting involved politically in the 1960s, and I began working with initially SDS and non-ethnic organizations. And I found that the way many of these organizations then and now address the questions of people of color were sort of a checklist or nominally so. I felt a need to move from that community to a Chicano student organizing community and so forth. And I found, and I've maintained that relationship all my life, that is that it's not an either or situation. I think if you frame the question the way you have in terms of trade-offs, then we begin to see what is the relative merits of doing this as opposed to doing that. I would argue that the way we should frame the issue is how can you do this and do that to strengthen, in your case, both sides of the dichotomy. I don't see it as a dichotomy necessarily. I think that there is significant strength in organizing within your community, because I can do it, for example, in the Chicano community, and perhaps you can't. But I think for me to isolate myself and do that and not communicate with you, I think is a detriment to both what you're doing and I'm doing, and so forth. So I think it's important for us to think globally and act locally, and that's what I've done over the years, and I think that's the way we should think about these questions rather than just neither or.
From my experience, I found that I'm seeing just the opposite, that it's only, at least from an ethnic or a racial standpoint, that the networks are only bringing more people together that previously would never have crossed paths in a lifetime. I do understand your concern about the issue of, in terms of thought process or political leanings, that you know people are sort of, you know, only associating with the same folks, but I don't see that as a particularly cyberspace related problem, because it seems to only be mirroring what occurs in the general society. I mean, I don't think I'm going to be having lunch with Newt Gingrich tomorrow. I mean, whether in cyberspace or in the real world. So I think that's just the way it is on a day-to-day basis, that you know people tend to do that. So it's not really, I don't see that as a, you know, as a really a cyberspace problem. I think actually cyberspace has had a positive effect in that area. There, I can just, from my own personal experience, the wide range of people that I've met or who have become friends with would never have happened without, you know, this communications technology.
I'd like to add just a short comment. I also serve as a non-trustee board member for the National Museum of the American Indian. It hopes to build a facility on the Washington Wall next to the National Air and Space Museum, and it hopes to have a Suitland, Maryland research center. They had an opening for the Custom House in New York City last fall. Tribal America is looking very carefully about the issue of how to exchange and share and strengthen cultural positioning. Not only from a learning context with the communities, but how do we share information with the next generations? And noting that under the current museum practices without technology, many of our children have and probably never will have the opportunity to travel to Washington, D.C. to see much of the cultural patrimony and the materials that have been collected over the years. I think this offers that idea of global exchange, the idea of multimedia. It opens up new doors and possibilities of sharing and exchanging and to some extent negotiating, starting that dialogue for in tribal communities. The issue of repatriation, the return of cultural properties is an important issue. But within the communities, we have Indian radio out there. We're starting to look at, it's a mix of mediums, I think. So when you talk about just the Indian techies, talking to the Indian techies, well, so to some extent it is that. But at the same time, we have a lot of opportunities to mix computer network access with, say, the Indian radio station, maybe the cable programmers that are coming up with new ideas there for program distribution and public access to some channels there. So, and the newspapers, the Indian newspapers, it's all not going to die tomorrow. The paper guys aren't going to go away. But how do we get a qualitative impact of all the merged medias to build our economy, our economies and the communities internally and strengthen them, and then go from there about what do we want to do about developing a broader national cultural policy agenda of how do we share information with the larger globe, and to remember that we're not just this thing about there's a third world out there. Hey, this is, it's a one world. Get real, this is one world, you know.
CFP 95 was sponsored by ACM, the Association for Computing Machinery, and Stanford Law School. This segment was produced for Internet Talk Radio by Greg McVicker of Pacific Multimedia in Walnut Creek, California. The executive producer was Carl Malamud. This is the Internet Multicasting Service.